Good. Well, welcome to this evening. This is a very kind of practical session tonight, and I would also like you to feel free to interject and interact, ask questions, or give your own observations or experiences that you feel might be helpful. And this evening, we're working through several areas, depending on how much time we have. We're going to have a look at the impact of chronic illness on marriage. Now, please, if you're here as a single person, I'm not minimizing the impact of chronic illness on singleness, but there are some particular dynamics in the area of marriage that I want to touch on. Then we're going to be looking at the area of what I call Samaritans, and that's the other side of the coin. That's those who might be relatives of somebody who is ill, might be a parent, might be a neighbor, might be a church member. Some of you are here simply because you're church members and you're concerned about this area. Or you might be a professional caregiver. That might be one of your roles. And if so, you're a very important person, and we want to look a little bit at that area. And tomorrow morning, when Paul is back with us, he's going to mention a group based here called Christian Caregivers. There are some of these brochures over on the desk. And could I just mention two things, that tomorrow in the small groups, there will be groups for those who have illnesses, and groups for those who give care. And so that's why it's important that you sign up so that we can place you in one of those groups. And then if you're here just with a general interest, some of you will go into one group and some into the other. So keep that in mind, and also get one of these brochures if you'd like one from the desk later on. Good. We're going to begin then by looking at the impact of chronic illness on a marriage, on Ray and Rennie and those kind of yokings. And it might be also interesting at some stage if those of you who are single here want to add some of your own perspectives. I had a chronic illness for 10 years before I was married, so I know some of the particular pressures there. But the chronic illness that does not stress a marriage is exceptional. Hardly any aspects of the relationship will be unaffected. And it's very, very common when somebody is in a chronic illness, sometimes a terminal illness or a disability, for their marriage to break down under those pressures. That, and there are people in this room, I won't point them out, but some of you have shared that with you, that it was your illness that collapsed your marriage. So there's some very important things here that we want to touch on, and please feel free, after I've given a little, we're going to go through four or five sections. We're going to look at marriage, we're going to look at Samaritans, we're going to look at your relationship with physicians. And we've got at least one, perhaps two physicians with us, and they may want to comment. We're going to look at the church and the role of the church in the area of chronic illness or disability. So some very kind of practical things tonight, and I want you to feel free to interject, to ask questions, or to give your own observations. But first of all, let's just run through some points on marriage, and then I'm going to open it for some questions in the area. Number one, just to say that often an acute illness will eventuate in intimacy. A chronic illness will often eventuate in distance and divorce. There's something about when something is acute, it's an emergency, we all rise to it, you know. And often, you know, somebody can say, you know, I just went through a medical crisis and it was so wonderful. My relatives gathered round. My spouse was so supportive. The church rushed in to see me, you know, night and day. And it's very, very different to something that grinds on year after year and actually seems to create distance in a relationship. And that's partly due to grief. You remember we said this afternoon that grief, when it's shared, it isolates. It isolates because you can't quite be there for each other in the way that you were before. So, number one, stand in each other's shoes. Stand in each other's shoes. Now, why this is important is that what I've noticed with my own situation is that, and I'm very grateful for this, is that folks are very concerned about me because I'm sick. And they're often asking me how I am. And often what they forget is Jenny's life. Jenny is not sick, but she is equally affected, 50% affected by my illness. And often in a chronic illness, the focus is on the person who's suffering rather than the person who is equally implicated. Their life is affected as much as yours. Now, why that's important, I say stand in each other's shoes, because I need at times to realize how my situation affects my wife. Obviously, if you're in pain, you're thinking, you hurt, you want relief, you want care, you want medication. But it's very, very important to stand in the shoes of your spouse and think what this means for them in their situation. Otherwise, your focus and the focus of your friends and the focus of the church is going to be lopsided, and somebody's going to be left high and dry and unsupported. Okay, so number one, stand in each other's shoes. And I remember Pastor was saying we go back a long way. We do. And I remember, Pastor, when in Lincoln, do you remember Jean Clark, who was very disabled, terrible, I can't remember what he had. Right, and when I was there, he could only really move his fingers, just in bed. And we used to go around there from the youth group once a year to do any work around the house, clean up the yard, any fixing and whatever. It was a fun day. The whole youth group would go. And I always used to think, you know, I was a little younger then. I mean, it was 30 years ago, but little. And I always used to think, imagine that. Imagine that, you know, being in bed day after day and not being able to only move your fingers. And how can the man, you know, and he was such a radiant Christian. And, you know, I never stopped to think once of the other half of that relationship. And there was a wife with fairly small kids then, as I remember, two small children coping with that. And my focus was on Gene in bed, only able to move his fingers, you see. I was young then. I believe there were other people around who were equally conscious of the other half of that equation. And that's very, very important. Number one, stand in each other's shoes. Number two, stay cheerful. Stay cheerful. Now, I'm speaking now not to the spouse. I'm speaking to the other half of the relationship. Most of the time, if Jenny was to ask me, how do you feel? I would say awful, because most of the time I feel terrible. Now there are some times when I feel good, I kind of surface, but they're few and far between. But it doesn't make for a very happy relationship if every time Jenny says, how are you, honey? I say, awful. How are you today, honey? Awful, you know. How's it going this afternoon, honey? Terrible. I mean, what fun to be married to somebody like that. You know, wouldn't that just be wonderful year after year? You know, what do they have to say? Awful. Terrible. The pain's killing me. You know, that doesn't make for a happy marriage. You say, what do you do then? I don't tell her a lot of the time. Okay, now what do I do then? I do tell her she needs to know. She needs to know, but not every day. Not every afternoon, not every night. She can pretty much read the signals now. She can pretty much read the... But why I'm saying that is a relationship can't survive on awful, terrible, you know. Bury me, bury me. She's supposed to be married to you, okay? So it's very important. Now, I have good friends here, and I can tell them at times how bad it is. But I'm not going to dump all that on Jenny, okay? So very important for us, that we stay cheerful, okay? Sometimes I feel awful. How do you feel?
Yeah, I think I'm doing pretty good today. Oh, that's a statement of faith at that point, but you know what I mean. Number three, and this backs up, use your friends. Normally in a marriage, normal marriage, normal situation, you can pretty much meet each other's needs. Okay? When you're running into chronic illness, terminal illness, you can no longer exclusively meet each other's needs. You need people to help carry the load. And I believe that that's why a lot of marriages break down, because you think, well, we always met each other's needs. You can no longer. The load is too heavy. Use your friends. Number four, avoid codependence. What I mean by that is that Jenny's life can't revolve around my illness. Okay? That is not healthy. I have to be prepared to release her from time to time. It's rather amusing at the moment, because for the last umpteen years I've been the one that's waved goodbye to my family and got on planes and whatever and gone to take conferences here and there around the world. Now it's rather amusing because Jenny's waving goodbye to me, and she goes off to, she went last year to England for 3 weeks. I nearly died. If it wasn't for a good number of people in this room, I would have died. Mindy phoning me up several times a day saying, are you still alive, and whatever. But why I say that's important is that her life cannot revolve around my illness. And I've got to be prepared to release her. Val and some of the others started something called the Royal Rifle Club. Now, you may not know what the Royal Rifle Club is, but when Jenny was out, I must tell you this story, it's so funny. Jenny went out with Mindy and Linda and Val and a few others who may be here. And basically, these taking my wife out to lunch has meant so much to her. You won't know. Because it gets Jenny out of the seriousness, and they laugh and they joke over lunch. But they asked Jenny, they made a terrible mistake one day. They asked Jenny, tell us something, you know, that you find, you know, unusual about the state. So Jenny thought, well, I better not talk about the Clintons, that's a bit controversial. And I try and talk about something, you know, that will be, you know, neutral. And so she started to talk about gun control. Can you imagine? Woof! Nebraska, gun control. Can you imagine that? So afterwards, this little group of ladies was called the Royal Rifle Club. And we get regular cards from a certain embossing company. I won't mention which embossing company. Certain embossing company with nice embossed cards about the Royal Rifle Club. Now, why do I say all that? That kind of thing is wonderful because it releases my wife into a wider circle of relationships and activities, which is very, very important. Very, very important. Sometimes I don't want to let her go, but other people rally around and help me meet my needs and the needs of my family so I can release Jenny into other things. Number five, be creative in discovering coping mechanisms. Because you have to shift the balance, tilt the balance, when you run into a chronic or a terminal or a situation of disablement. For many years, I realized that I couldn't do all the jobs a kind of husband needs to do and have my ministry. And so the Lord sent us some wonderful people. They were sometimes German, sometimes Turkish, I believe once French, who would come and live in our home for about 6 months because they wanted to learn English. And they came and they lived with us, and a wonderful blessing to our children, a wonderful help to me because it meant certain responsibilities I couldn't pick up were being picked up for us. And that was one of the Lord's provisions into our situation. God just sent us people, and they're still friends with us today. Sometimes in the relationship, I don't drive very well, so often Jenny will be driving, picking up the kids. And I would love to say of all the things I do in the house when she does this, but that would be bordering on telling lies. But I do try and do one or two things when she picks up my end of the load, so that I will at least, you know, have a few things back in the cupboards when she gets home. But that's very important. Number six, just going quickly through some of these areas, you need to talk it out. You need to talk it out. When Jenny and I came here a year ago, we realized that some things were so painful to us about what was happening because of my situation, we actually almost didn't have the emotional space to talk about them. Because you've got to continue to look after kids and run a family and whatever. And it was particularly meeting with Steve and Mindy that somebody walked through some of these areas that were almost no-go areas. Because, you know, when life is not easy at the best of times, you know, in normal marriage, normal health, and there's financial pressures and business pressures and pressures from children, there's not a lot of emotional space at the best of times. But when you get an illness dumped in there as well, and you're both trying, I mean, there's a lot of hidden fear. Will we cope financially? Will I have to stop working? What's going to happen to the kids? Will I die? And we don't like to talk about those things. But what begins to happen is that begins to build distance in there. There's a whole little reservoir building up in there that we don't talk about. And you need to. You need to. And somebody else will need to help you because you won't have the emotional space between you to do it. Somebody else will need to be there for you at that point. Number seven. Join support groups. A little bit more about that later on this evening, but that can be immensely, immensely helpful. We have neighborhood friendship groups here in Trinity, and they provide a level of support on the small group level. Even more so when you get together with a group of people who might be battling with the same illness you are. And you can, not in a depressive way, that's hopeless if you all tell each other how bad you are, but it's often much more creative of sharing with each other how you're coping and how you're doing. And it can be an enormous challenge to meet somebody who's got a similar disease to you and find what they're doing with their lives. You think, wow, if they can do that, I can do it too. And that can become iron sharpening iron, very, very helpful. Number eight, be courageous. I'm speaking for the sufferer now. Now, this is important. I don't think I've ever talked about this with Jenny, but I believe she would agree. It's very important for her to know that I'm fighting as hard as I can. Okay? I'm fighting my situation as hard as I can. The reason for that is that she has to fight whether I fight or not. Do you see what I mean? Now, let's take it one step further. Let's take somebody is in hospital. Okay, it's important for the spouse to know that they're fighting because the spouse has got to fight. She's got to go home, cook meals, pay bills, look after children, run a household, balance. There's no option for fight over there. And it's very important to balance the equation that they know that we're fighting too and not just crumbling and capitulating. Very, very important. Number nine, be sensitive to the needs of your children. Be sensitive to the needs of your children. Children need three things out of us. Number one, they need our availability. One of the things I'm very conscious of is all the things I've never ever been able to play ball with my children, or football, or baseball, or any of those kind of games with my children. I'm very conscious of what I was never able to hold my children after they were a certain weight. Could never hold them, sit them on my lap, but never pick them up, never throw them in the air, never wrestle with them on the carpet. Very, very aware of that. And I will moan about this to Jenny, and she will say to me, yes, but think of what you can do, that you're there for them. And the first thing that children need is they need your availability. And you can be there for them. You can be there for them. One of my favorite authors, who is Chesterton, he became such a lovely man because his father, who had a heart disease, decided to retire and just be there for his boys. Just be there. And he owed everything to his father. They need our availability. Number two, they need our honesty, because it's curious with children. You can get something like arthritis, bad arthritis, and the kids kind of know dad is not well, or they won't ask you this, but they will be thinking, are you going to die? They won't ask you this, but you're ill. Are you going to die? Okay? And you need to be honest with them. If you are terminally ill, you can talk that out with them and say, honey, I don't know, but this is in the hands of Jesus, and we're praying and trusting him. If it's more a chronic situation, you need to reassure them, because medical terms get very frightening, confusing for children, and you need to be honest and talk it out. They need that from you. You need to be available, you need to be honest, and they need your adult friends. And that's very, there's all kinds of things that I've never been able to do with my boys, but I thank God my friends have done it for them. When we came here, Dell took Mark hunting. Wonderful experience. I couldn't do that for him. In the summer, some others took them water skiing. I can't do that for them. And so they make it up. They make it up. And so they share my adult friendships. And lastly, before I move on to another section or offer contributions from the floor, lastly, I say, team up together against the disability out there. In other words, Jenny, if you'll just come here a minute, we need to objectify it, and rather than it needs to be before us as a problem we're tackling together, we need to it needs to be, as it were, before us rather than between us. Because if Jenny's looking at me seeing my disability, and I'm looking at Jenny sensing my failure and my lack, do you see where it is? It's right here between us. But what we need to do in a marriage is come together and say, now we've got something we need to overcome. There it is out there. This is what we're tackling. And we somewhat objectify it. And that's very important that we do that together. Okay, one last little quotation. Then I'll ask if you have any contributions before we move on to the next area. This is by a surgeon. I've read this once before. Some of you may have heard it. He comes into the hospital room after he has performed an operation on this lady, and there's her husband there as well. He said, I stand by the bed where a young woman lies, her face post-operative, her mouth twisted in palsy, clownish. A tiny twig of the facial nerve, the one to the muscles of her mouth, has been severed. To remove the tumor on her cheek, I had to cut the little nerve. Her young husband is in the room. He stands on the opposite side of the bed, and together they seem to dwell in the evening lamplight, isolated from me, private, gazing at each other and touching each other generously. The young woman speaks to me. Will my mouth always be like this? She asks. Yes, I say it will, because the nerve was cut. She nods and is silent, but the young man smiles. I like it, he says. It's kind of cute. He bends to kiss her. You'd better read it, Joel. The end there.
He bends to kiss her crooked mouth, and I so close I can see how he twists his own lips to accommodate to hers to show her that this kiss still works.
Yeah, good. The kiss still works. It's lovely, isn't it? And that's something of the beauty that can be worked into a relationship. Okay, a lot of beauty can be worked into it. I've mentioned the negative side, but there can be a beautifying side as well. Now, before we move on, any comments from the floor, either from the marrieds or from the singles? Things you'd like to say? Yes. In a spouse. Okay, our friend over there, in case you couldn't hear at the back, he says he's been, had a chronic illness for 5 years. What kind of character should he look for in a spouse? I guess a saint. You look for somebody who loves you, okay, who sees you, who doesn't identify your illness. Your illness is not your identity, as we said this afternoon. And it's lovely. I thought one of the most beautiful marriages in recent times was when Johnny Erickson got married after being a quadriplegic for so many years. Somebody fell in love with Johnny. Johnny, not a disability. And I think the only way I could answer our friend over here is somebody will love you for who you are because your illness is not your identity. Okay? Not at all. Not at all. Okay, any other questions or comments? Yes. Okay. So your question is, you want to help. You want to help into a situation, but they're closing you out.
It seems that way.
Okay.
I'm sure that that's the case.
Okay. Let's hold that till we go into the next section on giving care. Okay. And we should cover that then. Okay. That I'm going to come to that tonight on the section on the church. But that's such a crucial point, and I don't know if our wonderful spirit-filled doctors back there will shoot me down at this point. I'm always nervous in this area with you brothers in the room, but give me grace. I was reading just recently that much of the focus of medicine is on cure. Okay, and we thank God for that. But there's another whole side of medicine that's been there traditionally, right down through the history of the church, that's also been on care, caring. And sometimes when we feel we can't cure, either medically or even with prayer, you know, we kind of back off when we don't realize at that point they need our care more intensely than ever before. But it's amazing how Christians can back off. They don't know what to say, they don't know what to do, and we'll come round to that one a little bit later on. Okay, anybody else want to comment? Yeah, over the back. Yeah.
And maybe I didn't reach out to
the right
group.
Right. That's right. God gives you the friends you need. God gives you the support you need. And that's very true. That while I've majored on marriage because there are particular dynamics, I know of single people. And aloneness, you remember, God said it's not good for man to be alone. Aloneness is not only compensated for in marriage. As a single person, God can give you precious, precious friends who stick closer than a brother to support you and be there for you. Okay, anything else anybody would like to add at this point? Sorry? Yeah, Jenny wants to.
One thing that's been important to me, is this one? Is trying to keep, and I've only really seen this with my mind the last year or so, is trying to keep a balance between what I would call normality and reality. And when I say normality, I think we've had a pretty normal life, you know, in spite of Ray's disability. And we have four kids, and I think they've turned out pretty normal. They're like normal kids to me. But I think that's because, in a way, we've just got on with life and we've lived it as normally as possible. And so, for example, maybe this is just my personality, maybe not everybody can do this, but for example, from my own point of view, you know, sometimes I think, well, we need to get out and the kids need to do something, like, was it last weekend or the weekend before? I thought, we need to get out in the country, but Ray can't go. He can't travel that far. He can't hardly travel anywhere. And so, but I don't think, oh no, I can't go, so we can't go to the country, so we can't do anything. I mean, we just have got on and lived normally. So I usually find a friend or somebody else to go with. I prefer it that way. If Ray was well, we would go together, but I go with somebody else. So what I mean is, we have learned to live our life as normally as possible. But on the other hand, I think that when we were talking, particularly last year when we were talking with Steve and Mindy, I think I realized there was also a point where you can live so normally that almost you don't perhaps together face what the reality of the situation is. And there are certain things that we have found, sometimes curious things that nobody would ever think of, that are actually, they do cause a problem. For example, let me tell you this, because this actually was quite a difficult thing, but it kind of illustrates, because people say to me all the time, oh, you know, how do you do it? How do you manage? How do you live with this? Well, I don't
relate to this. How does she live with me is what I mean.
Sorry, I'm ignoring everybody over here. I don't relate to that too much because I don't think of it like that. But for example, this is I think actually a good example because you'd never think of it. When we first came to the States 2 years ago, a very good friend of ours in Minnesota, very good friend, he offered to send us all to Disney World,
Disney World in Florida.
Disney World in Florida. Yeah. And of course, you know, our kids, they heard about this and they just thought this is the most wonderful thing they'd ever heard in their lives. But you see, the thing is, it actually raised the difficulty, and we kind of fudged this for a long time for different reasons, because we weren't really facing, I'm talking about Ray and I, we weren't really facing the reality of it. But the reality of it is that Ray couldn't go. The reality of it was I could go and the kids could go, but he couldn't go. So you see, the real thing about it is, do I go with my kids to Disney World, and they're all going crazy all over these slides, and they want me to go on everything? I don't know if I could manage that. Maybe some single parents could manage that, but I don't know if I really wanted to do that. But of course, if we didn't go, they would be very disappointed. And so, was there any other alternatives? I can't remember. But there seemed a kind of a number of different kind of issues.
One of the other issues that's difficult is that I could go, but I run the risk of being very unwell for a long time because I have an inflammatory nerve problem, and if it hits it, I could actually go, and it could take me 3 months to get over going, you know. And so you kind of run the risk. I would love to go. You know, the kids have been offered it. You know, we want to go. We'll only be in the States for a couple of years. We'll never have this opportunity again. So we're also balancing, you know, the risk of a wonderful week, but then Dad is, you know, ill for 3 months. You know, how do you possibly? Now, it might be that I could go and not be, you know, but all these equations, you know, come into play.
And also there's the kind of, if I could put it, a spiritual aspect, which we'll probably come on to tomorrow, in that I was thinking, well, maybe Ray's going to get healed and then we could go, you see. So there's all That's these right. different kind of scenarios all at the same time. And I think for a long time, we just kind of put it off. We just kind of, you know, the kids would ask us and we'd say, well, not yet. You know, but really what we were not doing is really facing this. And, you know, in a sense, it doesn't matter what we decide. But the point was, is that we weren't really facing the issues. And what I'm trying to say is that most of our life is not like that. Most of our life is just getting on with everyday life. But at the same time, there is an aspect where you have to face certain things. And they come in kind of curious clothes. They're not kind of the most important, usually the most important things in life, but somehow they do affect you all, you know, because then I'm feeling bad for the kids, and I'm feeling, oh, I wish Ray could come, and I'm feeling, thinking, I don't know if I can manage
and
this.
I'm feeling a failure because I can't go. And
so there's all kinds of things coming in here, but we're not talking about it because we're just kind of putting it off. And so it's these kind of issues that I think, you know, that kind of people looking on our lives wouldn't normally think. They're either thinking you're living such a terrible life all the time, which is not true, or at least I'm not living a terrible life. Maybe Ray is, but I'm not. Or
I feel wonderful. I feel great. I feel fantastic.
Or they're thinking, you know, you're having terrible struggles about the most important things in life. But often it's these curiously
small things
that actually bring the real issues to the surface. And I think I would say the real answer to the second one is to have good friends like Steve and Mindy. And maybe we should sit down with them more often, you know, and talk through things that are not big issues, in some ways not big issues, but we realize they're issues that are coming in.
I thought the real answer was for Disney to build in Omaha. And it's interesting that I heard reports issued, I think, by the British Medical Association a couple of years ago, and they were saying more and more that they felt that the training, the kind of standard training of you must not get emotionally involved with your patients, was very, very wrong. Because they were feeling more and more that the role of a healer is to weep with those who weep and to laugh with those who laugh. And of course, that's what the scripture says. And I think this is why this is a uniquely Christian area of coming alongside some people. So just a few points I'll go through and then we'll open it up. Number one, for caregivers, number one, avoid trying to answer why. Avoid trying to answer why. Just a little quote here. If you think your task as a comforter is to tell me that really, all things considered, it's not so bad, you do not sit with me in my grief, but place yourself off in the distance away from me. Over there, you're of no help. What I need to hear from you is that you recognize how painful it is. I need to hear from you that you're with me in my desperation. To comfort me, you have to come close. Come sit beside me on my mourning bench. And that's very important, because often as Christians, we think we must have to have discernment or revelation, and somebody says, you know, why is this happening? And we think, we've got to come up with a spiritual answer. You know, they're asking, and I feel myself, we're supposed to be pastors or counselors. We've got to be able to say something here. And you know, so often, I've found that the best thing you can say is put your arm around somebody and say, I am so sorry. I am so sorry you're going through this. And I don't want to keep embarrassing Steve and Mindy, but they've helped Jenny and I so much over the last year that I remember about 6 months ago, I went through a real dip and Steve and Mindy came round to pray for me. And I don't despise, you know, people want to give you, a prophetic word, or they want to give you some sort of, well, I think this is this is attack from a certain quarter, and I appreciate all that. But Mindy just came in with Steve and sat there and wept and said, Ray, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And that did more for me than an hour of counseling could have done, because they came and sat with us on our mourning bench. And that's very, don't feel you have to give a why. Don't feel you have to give a why, you don't. Number two, as a caregiver, do it as unto the Lord. Do it as unto the Lord. We have the phrase in our culture, you owe me one. You know, you owe me one. And that's impossible in this relationship, because I owe so many people so much for so long. I'm eternally in debt. But when we give care, we have to give it as unto the Lord. Give it as a, you don't do, somebody ask Johnny Erickson's caregiver once, who would care for Johnny, a youngish girl, for I think about 5 years. They said, you know, don't you regret having given up the best 5 years of your life? And she was horrified, and she said, this has been my service for the Lord Jesus over these 5 years. I haven't done it for Johnny Erickson. And so do it as unto the Lord, inasmuch as you've done it to one of these, the least of my brethren, you've done it unto me, the Lord said. Number three, set limits. Now obviously, if you're a professional caregiver with a professional contract, this doesn't apply so much. But I'm thinking now, you might be a neighbor, you might be a church member, you might be a friend, and you need to set limits. Time and time again, I've seen people driven away who came in to help, and the person in need was so demanding. I remember a lady in London who the church rallied round her when she got this illness, and they cared and they shopped and they looked after her children, but she got more and more demanding, and she didn't just want coffee, she wanted her particular brand of coffee, you know, even if it wasn't in the store, you know, please go back and get it. And so she kept, and pretty soon they dropped off one by one. They couldn't go, and she ended up isolated. And so as a caregiver, set limits. Say, I can do this, I can't do this. I can be with you for this, I can't for that. And somehow that clears the air and it helps the relationship. So set limits. Number four, in a general relationship of giving care, avoid always asking, how are you? How are you? Okay, don't make their health the basis of your relationship. Okay, don't make their health the basis of your relationship. Okay, and so don't, sometimes I'm totally perplexed because I thank God there are a lot of people around here who care for me, but it's hard for me to walk through the fellowship hall without somebody either offering to pray for me or asking me, how are you? And it's a difficult thing, you know, what level do you want, you know? Do you want the full story? Sit down, get some food. This is going to take a long time. Or, you know, do you want the happy, I'm fine? It's a very complex question to answer when you've got a chronic illness. And I'm also amused because, you know, sometimes I go through kind of dips and highs. And, you know, I've gone through a dip, but by the time the word gets round, I'm climbing out again. And so everyone's rambling around. I heard you've really been bad. And I kind of, You know, I'm kind of on to the next bit now. And so avoid making their health the basis of your relationship. That's important. Number five, I mentioned this afternoon. When appropriate, use touch. It's interesting, isn't it, that in the scriptures, healing comes through what? The laying on of hands. I mean, God could have said the laying on of books. You know, why not lay books on people, you know? Let's get some books. I'm going to heal you by the laying on of books. I mean, it wouldn't be so nice. It's a wonderful book. But there's something, and Jesus didn't have to touch the leper. You remember, at times he healed with a word, or he healed at a... Why did he touch the leper? Because nobody touched them. Nobody ever touched them. He didn't need to touch them to heal them, but you see, they needed to be touched. And touch is sometimes a very wonderful thing when you're ill. Very wonderful thing when you're ill. And so don't be afraid to do that. Don't be afraid to do that. It can be very much used by the Lord. Number six, avoid pity. I said that this afternoon. Always in any situation of care, you're on the outside looking in. And what you can't see is the grace that God is giving that person, because he says, as your days are, so will your strength be. And you can't see the grace that God is giving them. You're on the outside looking in. And so don't use pity. Pity doesn't help. Pity doesn't help. Usually makes you feel worse. Okay, avoid pity. Number seven, be cheerful. Be cheerful. Okay? We think we have to be serious around the sick. Okay? You know, we've got to, you know, they're sick, and you better be solemn here. And, you know, please be cheerful and happy, you know, around the sick. Don't they? And I can't resist. I was with... Pastor and Nancy a couple of weeks ago, and you've got to tell the story, Doc, about when Tozer finally made his hospital call. Come on, you've got to tell us this one. Now. This is... Use the microphone. It's worth the telling. Give them a little background that he never made.
How many of you have ever read anything about Dr. A.W. Tozer? How many of you have ever heard about it? Hands again. Dr. A.W. Tozer passed on the south side of Chicago for 33 years. His articles appeared in the Last Witness forever and in books on both sides of the Atlantic. Now, he was a prophet with a capital P. He was a real prophet, and not given to pastoral care. And he stayed there 33 years, and his eldership tried to pick up the pastoral end of it. Now, the rest was God take care of them. He spent all his time with God in writing and guiding the church universal. A couple of the favorite people there, one of them was... Marjorie Anderson. Marjorie Anderson was a singer in the church, and she also sang all over Chicago. Chicago's a big town, 6 million people. And she'd be in leading oratorios and stuff like that, and cantatas and that type of thing, and Handel's Messiah, that type of thing. And so he loved her because she had music, and her music was always touching to his heart. He never made pastoral calls. Other people did that. He had a song leader named Ray McAfee. Ray McAfee was single, by the way, and he was a fine singer and loved music, and so they always had a close relationship. McAfee told me once that in 18 years of working with Dr. Tozer, he never once could find one word. He'd look for great big polysyllabic words and try to spring them on the doctor and ask him, do you know what this word means? In 18 years, he never could stump him once for his vocabulary. And my favorite word from Dr. Tozer is sesquipedalian, great big sesquipedalian words, which means a foot and a half long. I didn't know until I looked it up. Now, so one day McAfee said, Marge Anderson's in the hospital. Oh, I said, that's too bad, it's too bad. He said, I know it's too bad. We've got to go. He said, no. I said, why don't you go? He said, no. He says, she's sung here faithfully, and she's done this, and she's done that. You ought to come and visit her. Oh, well, okay. And he just wasn't given his whole nature. When the service ended in the morning, he'd go down to the nursery and see the kids, little babies. He loved children, and he loved cats. But he was uncomfortable with adults, and that's just how he was built. So McAfee prevailed upon him to go and make this hospital call to see Marge Anderson. I forget what it was. It was enough to put her in the hospital, but she wasn't, you know, in any critical danger or anything. And so he said, okay, all right. So Dr. Tozer was a little man. He's probably about 125 pounds. And when you think of the prophet, you think of the great fiery prophet, flowing beard, 6'6", and this type of thing. He was a little bit wispy kind of a guy. And he came rolling in this little walk and to the hospital. And they came into Marjorie Anderson's room. And McAfee went in first, and then came the doctor. And he says, Marjorie says, Dr. Tozer has come to see you. And she took one look at him. She goes, my God, am I going to die?
Okay, a couple more things, and then just responses from you. Number nine, listen. I was talking, eight. Open windows to the wider world. Open windows to the wider, don't just go and talk about their illness. When I was more or less confined to home for some years, I used to have a pastor who used to come in and teach me Greek. In some ways, I didn't want to learn Greek, but he was opening a window for me to a wider world. Johnny Erickson, an old man, came in to her hospital room. He was an artist, and he taught her to hold the brush in her mouth and to paint. He came in day after day. He didn't come in just to talk about her paraplegia. He came in to open a window to the wider world, and that's important. Number nine, listen. And John Donovan said to me, he said, as doctors, we're paid more for stitching your hand than holding it, which I thought was an interesting comment. And doctors are often paid more for procedures than they are for talking. And so we need to be those who will listen, and listen well. And it's not easy to listen well. I can't help reading this to you, which I found in a magazine a little while ago. Not about Dr. Tozer, but it nearly does as well. This is somebody commenting. He said, last week in the elevator, a man asked my mother, how are you? Since mother had just spent 3 hours with a tax collector, she smiled graciously and said, lousy, thank you. The man returned the smile and said, that's nice. Mother suspected that either he had misunderstood her or was simply a sadist. However, later the same day, she passed a woman who said, how are you? Suicidally distraught, said mother. Fine, said the woman. I hope the family's well too. This second exchange gave mother a revelation. If you're well enough to be talking, people consider your condition superb, even if you've just colorfully described an internal hemorrhage. Mother's pioneering experiment has inspired me to continue her work. Yesterday, I made real progress. How are you? Asked a man in front of my house. I'll be dead in a week, I said. Glad to hear it. Take care now. Thank you. Someday, perhaps, when I'm under a bus getting the last rites, I expect such a man to throw me a breezy, "How are you?" As well as can be expected, I'll say, "Good." And the kids? The older one goes to the chair tomorrow, and the little one was lost on a scout hike. Swell. The wife okay? She just ran off with the milkman. Glad to hear it. You'll have to bring the whole family over one night soon. Now, the amusing thing about this, the amusing thing, I shared this with Jenny, and this is just natural, this is no criticism, but just about a week later, Jenny was crossing the fellowship hall, and one rather, you know, harried mother was passing her, and she said to Jenny, "Oh, how are you?" And Jenny had really had bad, and Jenny said, "Oh, I'm not very well." She had really bad, and the lady smiled and said, "That's nice," and she went on. So listen. And finally, don't wait to be asked if you're a caregiver. Not professionally, I know that's a different relationship, but as a friend, as a relative, there's a lot of things I can't do physically, and I hate to phone people to ask them. I hate it. I'll write a list of people, and I don't know why I find it so difficult to ask, but I do. Often something breaks in the house and I can't fix it because I can't get down in the corner to do it or whatever. And I hate to ask. And just once in a while, you know, somebody will phone and they'll say, you know, don't say to people, if there's anything you need, phone me. Because that's not true. But you can say, you know, I'd love to do this if you ever need it. What you can do. That really helps because you feel you can go back to that person. And a lot of people say, anything you need. Yeah, there's a dozen things I need. You know, but it doesn't work that way. But sometimes people will, you know, say to me, "Ray, if you need, you know, something fixed in the house, you know, give us a ring." And I know for those small jobs, they're happy for me to do that. So don't wait to be asked, but make it known that you're there to help. Now, response from others in the room. This is an important one. Just take a couple of minutes on it. Response from others in the room. Yes. Yeah, yeah. And there's a kind of shorthand where "how are you" is a little bit like saying hello. Right. And if folks, we know that, you know, you pass, they say "how are you," it's kind of like just saying hi, you know. But sometimes, you know, folks do want to know how I am, and I need to listen to that and not, you know, run them down with just a fine, because they really are asking. But it's sometimes difficult as a person to know whether they're just saying hi. So usually with me, people say to me, "Ray, how really are you?" And then I know I need to give them, they want to know, and I need to answer. Yeah.
I often say I'm okay, and then if somebody that knows me well and understands the problem, then they will.
Yeah, they'll probe you further. They'll probe you further. That's right.
But I just say, "Oh, I'm okay."
Yeah. Mary?
How do you put it? Say you're feeling absolutely lousy.
Okay.
I find that what I say is, "I'm fine in the Lord."
That's right.
God,
that's good.
I'm fine in the Lord.
That's good. Mary's saying,
Mary's
saying, you know, what do you do? Because I can't emphasize enough, and I've talked to a lot of people, if you've got a chronic illness, it's a very difficult thing when people say, "How are you?" Because you don't know how to answer the question. It's one of those little things, you know. You don't know what level they're asking. And Mary's just saying, you know, if you feel terrible, when she says, "I'm fine in the Lord, I'm fine in the Lord." And that's a lovely answer. It's a lovely answer.
Yeah. I've had times where that's been very difficult too. But of late, I've gotten a little bit smarter about it. And I've asked them a question back in return. "Would you like to hear the truth or a lie?"
Okay.
"I will tell you the truth."
Okay.
It is not, you know, and then they understand it after you get to know them.
Yeah.
But I kind of turn it into a little joke, like, "Would you like to hear the truth or a lie?"
Yeah.
Which would you like?
Yeah.
And then they understand right away that you're probably not feeling very good.
Yeah, that's right.
But I quit the idea of saying fine when I'm not feeling fine, because I feel like I'm just playing line.
Okay.
I need to just let it out. And
right.
If they really, if they've got anything real, they'll understand you.
Yeah.
But and that's the kind of friends you need.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
It isn't always that way.
No.
But there are days when it's so lousy.
That's right.
That you wish you could hang it up and you know better.
That's right. That's right. That's where I think what Mary is saying about, you know, I'm fine in the Lord, is that she's answering, you know, not on behalf of her body, but on behalf of her spirit. That's rather a nice one. She's saying that, you know, I'm trusting. And
or if you wait, if you, instead of saying, well, how, you know, say, how are you? You ask me. I'll say, well, how are you?
Yeah, that's right.
Turn.
That's right.
Don't answer your...
No, that's right. Sometimes you'll reverse the question, how are you? And sometimes that what I've learned is not to be impatient with people, is that sometimes when you're meeting somebody casually, and if you're a Christian, you meet a lot of people at church, is that sometimes, you know, that when we're approaching someone, we see them coming and we think of, you know, what can I say? Like, it's just like if you bought a new car, people will say, how's the car? How's the car? Because they identify you. How's the new job? Well, when they see me coming, you know, they think, what shall I ask? How are you? Do you see what I mean? So I understand that they have, you know, they're asking, you know, to build a bridge of relationship, and they don't realize that that's often a difficult question for us to answer. Let's have any comments just for a minute from any caregivers here. Well, have the one at the back you are asking before. So. No, I know.
Other than the fact that I so appreciated people talking about things of mutual interest.
Yes. Not just about your illness.
Yeah. And one of the big thing that happened to me in the early part of getting better was I had people bringing groceries in. I had groceries delivered, etc. A couple took the time to take me to the grocery store, put me in an electric cart, let me do my own shopping, and run into people that I knew. And it was just fun. And
yeah.
It sounds so simple.
That's right.
That might be something that a caregiver wouldn't think about.
Yeah.
Take the individual out to do their shopping.
Right, right. Thank you. Very, very important. Connie, would you like to say anything?
People don't realize just the normal things, like brushing your teeth or putting on your clothes, or you appreciate it so much.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, and having someone around to help you do that is very, you're very appreciative of caregivers.
Yeah, that's right. It's a very...
Speaking from a person who's suffering, caregivers are a blessing.
Yeah, that's right. They are. And it's interesting that it's not easy to give care. It's not easy to give care. But when you really are, you know, when you're really disabled, you know, you can't dress yourself, you know, or you're, you know, I mean, my spells in hospital have been made notable not by my relationship with my surgeons, but my relationship with the nurses, whether they were good or bad. In fact, I had such a bad experience in one hospital, you know, with nursing care, that I refused to have the next operation unless Jenny could sleep with me in the room, which is very unusual in British hospitals, because I just had such a bad experience, not of the surgeons, but of the nursing care. And so care becomes unbelievably, because you're very vulnerable when you're ill. You're very, very vulnerable. And care is incredibly important. Okay, anybody like, yeah, let's just go over here.
Stretch, and from what I understand, the when the cancer gets in the lymph nodes, that you know, you don't recover. And they haven't told him that because he was telling these two friends of his how good he looked. You know, he said, "I look good, don't I?"
Okay.
And I'm gonna go see him probably Sunday or Saturday. And we were friends or acquaintances, and you know, the man died.
Okay.
What do I do with him?
Okay. Wonder if Mark and John Donovan can help us here. The question is that our friend, he knows his friend is dying, but it seems as if he's not been told that. How should he relate when he goes to see him? What would you folks say? Okay, tough question. Any guidance, John? Okay.
As a person.
Okay. Could you hear that over there? Yeah. Could you hear that at the back? Okay. Mark, anything you'd like to add?
So this gentleman is not saved. Correct.
He doesn't know the Lord. Okay. Pastor, you must have encountered this situation many times.
A couple of things. First of all, I want to work with a family, or I sometimes work with a doctor. I said, I was making a call one night, and she was very sick, a teenage girl in the church. I went in and I said to the doctor, I talked with her first, and I saw the doctor. I said, she's not well. I said, no, she says, family. Number two, as I talk to the family, not the sick person, I want to know how much they know, and thirdly, how much they've told the person. Now, if the person's critical and terminal and they don't know it, I'd say, you know, I want the doctor, you tell them, or if you don't mind, I'm going to tell them, because they need to know this. And secondly, if the parents or whoever, they should take the lead and let that person know how ill they are, most of the time, in my estimation. A man, my wife and I have an agreement, hopefully that's come to pass, if we ever have a sickness, if we have something that's declared medically terminal, we want to know. We're not going to play games. We both want to know. I may have things I want to finalize.
That's
I
right.
Have things I need to do. She may do
that's
the
right.
same. So I want the person to know as much as they should. Now, I know some people are going to say, doctors, I can help you out. Don't tell them that. They'll buy it. They'll die 2 weeks early. And I'm not a medical man, so I don't know that. But pastorally, I like to go through the authority levels of the doctor and the family, see what they're doing, what they know, what should be told. And then I feel the time comes when you say, if they want me to tell them, I'll say, Jim, you know, you always get a lot of life here, you've got a very bad sickness, and the medicine, the doctors say that it's not going to go well for you. We really need to look at life and see if they're not saved and see what life is all about, etc. Or if they're children of God, to say God has the best for us, or something to bridge over if it looks like God's not going to heal them.
That's right.
The doctors can help me on how much saying that to a patient may affect them.
I've been pastor many times also say that if he's witnessing or sharing the Lord with someone, to say, I would be telling you the same thing if you were in the pink of hell.
That's right. That's right.
I'm telling you now that you're
that's right. Yeah. Very interesting, yes.
She's talking about, I've talked with many, many terminal people. They've been unconverted. And I've built a relationship. I'm talking about, I say, now, Joe, I want you to know something. And sometimes I don't know them very well. If they've got a week to live, 2 weeks to live, I'll say, I want to share something with you. It's so important to all of us. And that's our relationship with Jesus Christ. I want you to know, I would share the same thing with you if you were in the pink condition. Because your sickness does not make what I'm going to say more important. It's the truth in itself. It's important enough in itself. But because you are sick, you may want to listen harder to what I'm saying. So I want to share this with you. And it doesn't because you're dying of cancer I'm sharing this. If you're my neighbor in perfect health,
you need to hear this too, because we all need the Lord.
That's right. Yes, Anne?
I've been a nurse for a number of years, and I've found a lot of times everybody's ignoring the fact that the person is going to die.
That's right.
They really want to talk about it, but no one allows them to do that. And so sometimes if you just give them a little opening, they'll pour out their heart to you, but doesn't even want to talk about it, And so they become very brave and are in denial.
That's right.
And then there are other times when I've seen people die in denial, saying that they are not going to die.
That's right.
That's the way they're going to be. That's the way they're going to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can kind of, if you give them a little chance, sometimes they'll open up.
Yeah.
Say things that they feel safe.
Very, very important. We would not be true friends, you know, if when somebody we know they're dying, we don't, you know, do this with them. It's a betrayal of friendship. And I was reading Dr. Jeff Kane, and he has done, sometimes when he speaks at a conference, he asks the group, he says, if you could choose how to die, how would you die? Now, these folks aren't Christians, you know, they're just asking them. If you could choose, most people will say, quickly, painlessly, in my sleep, or even an accident. And then he goes on to say that throughout the history of the church, the great fear was that you would have a sudden death. So because you needed to prepare for death. Most important thing. And there were actually prayers used in the church that God would deliver us from sudden deaths so that we could prepare spiritually to meet God. And now I know that in the medieval church that could be, you know, associated with certain rites in the church, but it contains an important truth. And it would be, if we get time tomorrow, I want to talk a little bit on death and dying, even though this is an illness on, this is a conference on chronic illness. But it's funny, even with thinking about that, you know, I tend to think, I don't want to talk about death. It's funny, isn't it? We don't want to talk about it because it's kind of in our society, you know, much like the Victorians didn't like talking about sex, we don't like to talk about death. You know, we don't like it. And yet, what an opportunity. You know, what an opportunity. If there's ever a time when the walls are going to come down, that's potentially it. And we do people a disservice. It's a little bit like Jenny was talking about no-go areas, and Anne was saying, everyone knows it, but no one will talk about it. That's foolishness. That's foolishness. Obviously, we're drifting, you know, more into the area of terminal illness, but it's very, very important. Now, we're going to need to close in just a minute, but I just want anybody else who is a caregiver here who just might like to, you've been waiting to say something, or Barbara, you were going to say something.
Well, I just wanted to comment on the fact that you made mention of the fact that God has given the person who is ill the grace to be in that position, and the grace to be, you know, who they are in that position, because I have a son that's in a wheelchair, and he had a brain stem stroke, and he really doesn't want his mother to be in a wheelchair. So I've been really seeking the Lord as to how I meet him. And over the last year and a half, I have seen such a courageous man.
Hmm.
I mean, I could not live the way he's living. Determined.
Mm-hmm.
And so one day after I'd been down there visiting, I decided that I wasn't going to try to say anything or do anything. I was going to go down there and listen to him if he had anything to say. Otherwise, I would just sit and watch the races on the TV or whatever, you know, just to be with him. And as I sat there and he shared with me that, I thought, oh my gosh, how courageous. So as I thought about that, and the next day I called him and told him just exactly how I saw him. And he said, well, you know, Mom, I don't have much of a choice, do I? I said, yeah, you do.
Mm-hmm.
You could be in self-pity.
That's right. That's right.
He's not sitting there. He's got a good mind, so he's using that in his reading and things like that. And so I think that helped to break through, for me to reach him. So
okay.
I'm glad you made reference.
Yes, very, very important, yes.
Okay, let me ask a question. Is this a caregiver question? Okay.
Not a question, but a comment.
Comment?
The master's
dignity. That's right, yes. Yes, that's right. Did you catch that over there? You'd like to say it again, just a little louder.
Okay. That the humility with which we ask for help is the same humility with which we need to offer the help.
That's right.
And that by setting limits, we set up boundaries in which they can ask for help with dignity.
That's right. That's right. Very, very important to feel we can ask for help with dignity. Just a couple of others and we'll close. Yeah.
How do I pray for my wife when she's in chronic recurring pains, when the prayers are essentially a repeat of yesterday's prayers and the prayers of the day before and the prayers of the last 2 years over the same illness, when I try to maintain a certain positive aspect of the prayer and belief for the healing,
thank you.
I heap guilt upon her when she doesn't manifest the very thing I prayed for.
Okay.
I literally become her enemy and she doesn't even want the prayer.
Right.
If it's a prayer of faith,
right,
claiming that which isn't,
yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Thank you, Phil. Yeah. Could you ask that question again tomorrow morning? Because I want to give that due space. I just want to stay with the caregivers before we close out. Now, Marilyn, you spend much of your life giving care. What do you need as a caregiver? Let's reverse it as we close. I was looking at the other Marilyn there. Two Marilyns next to each other. What do you, you give your life away. Marilyn's parents have Alzheimer's, and I think everyone that knows Marilyn knows that she gives her life away day in, day out, joyfully. What do you need as a caregiver? Either from us, as your church, or from your husband, or from your friends, what do you need? Okay. Did you hear that down there? Marilyn says that there are many times when she wants to run off and take a cruise. Just stand up, Marilyn, then they can just project, they can hear you a little bit.
Just grace and joy and even laughter. And you smile and you look at the word
salt.
I would
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And I'm hoping that, say Brenda Fox, the talk to me, she comes and talks to me, I would share my hand to her.
That's right. Really, you need your friends. You need your friends. That's right. Thank you.
I had misunderstood what you meant by caregivers. Because I know as a parent, like Jim just started a new job, he works nights. One of our big concerns, and Kathy's at the sweetheart, she's works for Social Security, so we have this real bond that we have. She sees me every month because we have to go and turn in pay stubs for David to become a medically, because any job situation that Jim has, because it's a pre-existing condition,
right.
And so he got this new job, he loves his new job, he's making good money, he's a manager, he has people under him. So naturally, you know, fear, which is not, do not worry, do not fret. But yes, we did. And, you know, so like, okay, now we're going to get more money, so then we're over the guidelines, so now we're not going to be covered medically. So that's a real concern.
Yes,
you know,
it
as
is.
To, you know, he's been doing real well. And then another thing is we like to have a date with our mate and on Saturday night. And a week ago, I started a new job, and I had to have training on a Friday. I had it all set up. Thursday night, I got a phone call that, you know, the babysitter couldn't make it. She had a doctor appointment for God. I spent from 5:27 till 9:17, called 27 people before I got somebody to watch him from 8 to 4 in 5 minutes. You know, and that's something I need.
Yeah, that's right.
Where I know on Saturday night at 5:30, somebody could come and watch David. So if Jim and I want to go have a nice dinner and be home by 10, we can do that and not feel guilty that we're inconveniencing someone. And it's important to me that when I'm gone, you know, they don't have to do dishes, they don't have to clean house. Beds are always made, dishes are always done. There's always food to eat. We have the whole Hanna-Barbera series of Christian movies. There's Bibleopoly. I mean, anything Christian you want in that house is there. And praise tapes are going constantly. And the only job requirement is come in and play with David.
Yeah. And I think that underlying your question, you're really saying that as sometimes you need
to maintain the daily sacrifice, you need a little window of escape.
I mean, I've got to have
then you can cope. That's right.
Is anybody else out there?
That's right. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Well, we're going to close now, but let me just mention one thing tomorrow, that in the small groups, which I think are later on in the morning, there will be two types of groups, and you'll be given a sheet of paper with your name. One group is for, as it were, caregivers, and this is people like yourself, there may be parents, maybe relatives, maybe professionals, for them to meet and share the very issues you're talking about. There'll be those kind of groups. Then there will be groups for those who have illnesses that they can share their concerns. And then there are a percentage of people at the conference. You're here simply because you're interested in this area. And so we will assign you to one group or the other of those two types. But you'll get your assignments at coffee time tomorrow morning. Okay, well, God bless you and have a good evening as you go.